Okay. Everybody set? We set? Okay. I'm Matt DeLand. I'm going to tell you about where we currently stand with the PMC measurements, the PMC data that we get from SPV measurements. I've not listed my usual collaborators, Gary and Eric and John, on this because most of this has been done in the last 4 weeks, and they're not responsible for what I may say about this at this point. I hope to correct that later. Okay. As John mentioned, the SBUV instruments, which comprises BUV, SBV, and SBV2, are instruments that are actually designed to measure stratospheric and total column ozone by looking in the nadir at UV wavelengths. It was figured out by Gary and Richard Peters that you could detect PMCs with these instruments. And because it's a long series of instruments, we actually have coverage going back to 1978. We've been able to use this data set to find both solar cycle variations and trends in PMCs. But an important thing to tell you, and I'll try to elaborate on it here, is that when we say the SBV data set, this is made up of 8 different instruments that have changing viewing conditions, different local times, orbit drifts. And so there's a lot that goes into making the sausage when someone says PMC data sets. And so I have an obligation to tell you a little bit about some of the issues that are part of this, because it affects both the magnitude of the trends, the latitude dependence, and in certain ways even the sign. So I will tell you about this. I'm going to hit some things very briefly, and please come ask me more questions later on things that I have to go over too fast. The instruments that we're talking about here, these are just the BUV type instruments. Nimbus 4 BUV actually has data from 70 through 72 in terms of decent quality data. I have not included those data in the trends at this point because the instrument performance has some hiccups, and I want to do that eventually, but I haven't been able to do it. Since then, we have a whole series of operational instruments. First, the Nimbus 7 SBV instrument, and then NOAA took over the second generation instrument. The red ones show you instruments that are still flying right now, so we actually have 4 different instruments up there collecting data. The OMPS instrument, which is a follow-on, was just launched on the NPP satellite last fall and is now collecting data. OMPS is supposed to fly also on the what's now called JPSS in 2016. Just for perspective down here, this is the seasonally averaged Lyman Alpha data that Tom Woods has put together to give you an idea of how the solar cycle variation shows up relative to this long data set, and you'll see more examples of how this fits in later. There are a number of issues that I'm going to try to touch on today, and these issues hit the data in different ways. The detection threshold test is something that comes through when I process any given set of measurements any given day from an instrument. When I talk about normalization for phase function effects and local time adjustments, this is something that I have to tie in when I create a seasonal average of the data sets. We're looking here at seasonal averages from a given instrument over a given latitude band. These are tweaks, knobs you can turn that come into play there. And then there are things that come into play when you actually try to calculate trends from the data. And so how do we combine the different satellite data sets? Do we do a single trend fit? Do we do multiple piece fit? And there are even other things. Okay. To detect PMCs from SBV instruments, we have to set a detection threshold in albedo because we're looking down at stratospheric ozone. There is essentially a noise floor that we want to be sure that we can claim, yes, this is a PMC. In previous work, what we've done is had a detection threshold shown by this red line. This is increasing solar zenith angle here, or scattering angle equivalent down here. This is essentially the brightness of the cloud. We had a detection threshold that was represented by this red line, and that red line tried to have a constant value at all latitudes. And the intent of that was thinking that the stratospheric ozone background was fairly similar with latitude. What that didn't do was take into account the different scattering angles that were represented at that same latitude. So for example, at 70 degrees latitude, you had scattering angle here of about 130 degrees or scattering angle of about 100 degrees, depending on whether you were the ascending node or the descending node of the orbit. So what I've tried to do in the current work has been to use a different type of threshold, shown here by the blue line, where the detection threshold is a function of scattering angle. That's something, I say this is something I can talk to you more about in detail later. It is a difference from the previous approach. And some of this is a review from LPMR for those of you who saw things there. In our previous work with SBV data, we have neglected making any adjustment to the brightnesses that we derive for scattering angle effects, for phase function effects. SIPS makes use of this all the time because as you go into the forward scattering regime, you get a significant increase in brightness of what you view for a cloud. In previous work, we've ignored that, but depending on what model you assume or what type of particles you assume, we may not necessarily be able to neglect it. This curve is from work that we published with the OMI data, where we actually go past 90 degrees because that instrument looks off to the side. But you can see that for SBUV observations here, if you assume smaller particles, this dashed line, maybe you only have at most a 10 or 20% effect. But if you assume larger particles, these sets of numbers are taken from Gerd Baumgarten's work, you can have almost a factor of two effect at the smallest angles we look at. So one of the things that I've done in the process of what I'll show you here has been to take the albedo for the detected particles, detected clouds, and scale it based on this phase function.
Excuse me. If you do have questions during the talk, if they're for clarification, why don't you go ahead and do that, because you'll probably forget the question by the time the discussion comes around. Is that okay if
whatever you want?
If you could repeat the question. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'll let you go.
Okay. Okay. Let me just talk. I'm going to spend a couple slides talking about local time because that has an impact on the clouds and how we put the things together over the course of a season. For an SBUV instrument, when you make observations in its normal orbit, in an afternoon orbit, sun synchronous, the measurement sequence essentially comes up like this. This is now latitude here and local time here. We make measurements coming up the ascending node in your early afternoon. But then in the summertime, we actually go over and we reach as high as 81 degrees or so. We actually get measurements on the descending node side of the orbit at the same latitudes, but now at very different local times. And these measurements are separated in both local time and in scattering angle. I'm giving you typical values here for what it is at 70 degrees north. The orbits of all of the SBV2 instruments have drifted over time because the NOAA satellites are not locked into their orbit. So as that orbit drifts, the absolute local times represented here will change, but the separation will remain the same. The scattering angle difference between ascending and descending node gets pretty small as you get near the terminator. So if you look at the overall data set, what you find is this complicated looking picture. What this is showing you is in the latitude band 64 to 74 north at summer solstice, what are the local time values represented in the data set? And you see your afternoon values here. Let me just talk about NOAA 9 as an example in the red. You see the ascending node measurements here and the descending node measurements here. You see those measurements drift in local time by a couple hours. As the satellite gets closer to the terminator, the algorithm that I have runs out of ability to detect the clouds, and so there are some seasons that I have to skip. And then the instrument actually drifts through the terminator, becomes a descending node morning observation satellite. So now you get additional measurements here. And so the local time coverage from this one instrument in terms of what we need to understand for variations in clouds ranges from 4 hours to 21 hours. And with the multiple instruments that are represented in the whole data set, if you take a season out here and wants to say, what are we looking at for clouds, we have to have some idea of what's going on at quite a few different local times. There are different measurements that have given us some idea of what is present for local time variability. LIDAR measurements from Alomar have characterized that at one particular location and one latitude. That's shown by the purple curve here. Mike Stevens has done some very nice work with the shimmer data to find measurement local time variation at a lower latitude. I'll talk to you in a minute about how we came up with something like this green curve from our satellite data. From the SBV data, it's difficult to pull out a local time function. And while I can do it to some extent, there is uncertainty in that. To show you briefly about something that I have tried to do here today with looking at the latitude variability in local time. And that's the fact that the OMI instrument that I talked about before is it's a follow-on to the Thomson SBUV, and it's got a wide field of view telescope and hyperspectral measurements with a big CCD. So it gets very wide swath coverage at high latitudes, and so you can actually do multiple times a day every single day. And so you can build up local time variation from that satellite at different latitudes. And the key point out of this, and there's more, a lot that could be discussed here, the couple key points. One is that the amplitude of the local time variation that we see with OMI decreases with higher latitude. You can see a fairly significant feature here at 75 north, peaking at about 8 hours local time. That's very small when we get to 85 degrees north. The other thing is that from these OMI data, I can't distinguish whether this should be a diurnal or a semi-diurnal variation. You can see two curves fit here. Solid line is diurnal function. The dashed line is semi-diurnal. Both of them represent the data that I have very, very well. But they have very different behavior out here. And as you saw from the satellite data set, what variation I adopt here could have an impact on what we get when we try to put everything together for a long-term analysis. Okay. I don't want to kill you in terms of trying to explain that because it's confusing. The bottom line is, to do local time analysis with the SBV data, the best that I can do is take a ratio of descending node to ascending node data, look for a single season, look at all the instruments together, and then try to come up with a function that fits that. So the function that I established, this is just a prescribed harmonic fit, diurnal only, no semi-diurnal. If I take the ratio of that to the equivalent of the ascending node, descending node ratio with this curve, I can try to see how well it fits the points that I get from different SBV instruments. This is binned in 1 hour intervals just for convenience. What I find out of that is, in this case, is that the function I come up with for frequency ends up peaking at about 5 hours local time. For albedo, it's very interesting, as it turned out. The previous work that we had done, where we did not make any adjustment for phase function, gave peaks that had functions that had a peak at about 1 hour local time. Actually, I can show this in the next plot. And this is something that's similar to what we've used in previously. And you get a function that peaks here around 1 o'clock local time. And that's significantly different from the peak where you saw peaks in the Alomar data or in the Shimmer data. If I make a normalization of those albedo values to 130 degrees with a phase function, and then derive my local time fit, I get something now that peaks at about 8 or 9 hours, which is consistent with other observations. So I think that's something that makes more sense, and it's this function that I've actually used going on to look at the data. Okay, so now we start getting to some of the actual data. What I have here are all of the individual satellites processed, in this case, with the latitude-dependent local time adjustment. The season that's been used here is from solstice, the 40 days after solstice. And I've got two latitude bands and two hemispheres shown, 50 to 64 north and south, and then 74 to 82 north and south. I've got the other data, just not enough room to show everything. The vertical scales are significantly different here. This is frequency. This is only going from 0 to 8%. You can see there's a fair amount of scatter in here. It's difficult for SBUV instruments to pick out clouds at these low latitudes. This scale runs from 0 to 40%. We definitely do better at the higher latitudes in identifying the clouds. You can see long-term changes here. In northern hemisphere, you see a pretty clear rise. You see a good solar cycle. Southern hemisphere, definitely less evidence of long-term change. This is the similar plots now in albedo. In this case now, all the vertical scales are the same for these things. We have lower values at lower latitudes. We have some different behavior showing up between different hemispheres. Combining these data together to make a single data set is the next question about how we want to do the trend analysis. What we've done in the past, how far over time am I already, Gary? Probably bad. Okay. There are different ways to put the data sets together if you want to do the trend. What we did in our previous work was to calculate a reference fit to all the period that we have multiple data sets and normalize individual instruments based on that reference fit before we average everything together. This is what I'm calling calculated here. We did this for each latitude band separately. You could also just choose one single band, believing that you've got better performance in the data, and use that. Or you can just have no scaling adjustment for different satellites, simply average together all the points in each year as they come out. The choice that you make has a real does have an impact on the trends that you come up with. I'm going to show you results from one particular case here, where the normalization that's been done is using these calculated scale factors that I talked about. So these are now essentially extensions of data that we've published in the previous papers. Frequency on this side, albedo here, northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere, three latitude bands shown that we've used in previous papers. And then you can see the multiple regression fits that go through here. And the multiple regression has a single linear term and a solar cycle term. Okay. Everyone wants to ask about numbers. I will show you one set of numbers. There are a lot more numbers that can be shown. Again, this is for this one particular case in terms of how we did it. The trends that come out, the bold represents statistically significant using a formula that we presented in the 2007 paper that tries to account for some of the autocorrelation between data points and account for some of the seasonality. The actual one sigma from the multiple regression fit is shown here. Italic shows you linear trends that are negative. And you think, wow, there's a lot of negatives showing in here. I would also observe, however, that the correlation coefficient in pretty much all of these cases for the negative trends is very small. So while that number has come out negative statistically, I'm not sure what the real significance of it is. As opposed to, for example, trends here, you see fairly reasonable positive values. I have a column here for the lag, which is the lag of the solar cycle. These are what we did in the processing was to go through every half year increment, and what's shown here is simply the best statistical number. You could choose zero for every one of these columns and not change what you get qualitatively in these results. The actual numbers would change a little bit, but the qualitative sense, positive versus negative, would not be significant. This obviously is a very odd case. If I can show you the numbers, and I think for zero lag, this is like minus 4.5% or something. I just simply put up a consistent thing here. So we often get a lag, but I don't know that it's meaningful in terms of a physical process. Okay. Some of these numbers are different than what we've had in the past. Well, numerically, I can guarantee you these will be different from what we had before because I've done a number of different things in how the data are put together. In terms of changes being less significant or even negative in some cases, there are quite a number of different pieces that that can go into why that will happen. I've been discussing a number of these pieces before. The point here is to address the fact that the previous work we did for the 2007 paper, those data cut off in 2005. If you look at the raw data that I was showing, the data looked very flat for about the last 10 to 12 years. And if you simply take a linear, this long-term trend and put flatter data out on the end of it, the new trend is going to be flatter than what you got before. It turns out the way that we do the scaling factors, those calculated scaling factors, it gets you double because of how we calculate that reference line first. So that's one piece that's going on. And there's probably more things that I haven't mentioned. Let me just finish up with something that's been talked about with the model results, which is the idea of a trend that has more than one part to it. We said previously that we were using a linear trend simply because we didn't have a good indication of what a forcing for something other than a single linear trend should be. The Lima work that you're going to hear more about now has given some suggestions of what might represent a different kind of trend. The red here is showing you the calculated temperatures at 69 north and 83 kilometers. And you can see that you can look at this in two parts, a decreasing variation here, which would in principle correspond to increasing PMC frequency and brightness, and then a turnaround here that goes the other direction. Now, the interesting point to me is, where do you declare your turnaround point? What's your break point? This is about 1996, 97, 98. These values are all virtually identical. I don't know that you could claim any one of these as being better than another. The way that the PMC data vary, that makes a real difference if I go to calculate trends from that. And I've got two slides here to finish with to show you that. This is now doing the same linear regression analysis, just albeit in the northern hemisphere. I've got the numbers for the other cases. They're similar in character. So if I make the breakpoint in 1996, I get significant positive trends here in the first half of the record, negative trends in the whole second half of the record. If I make the breakpoint in 1998 instead, I get positive trends again in the first half of the record, larger positive trends, and I get positive trends in the second half of the record, but with almost no solar cycle term. And say, what's going on? Is he cheating? No, I'm not cheating. But here's what happens when you actually look at the data that go into that fit. Here's the 1996 split case, and that line here is showing you where that falls on the data points. The PMC data have a large amount of variability between 1996 and 2000. If I make the cut point in 1998 instead, remember I based this looking at the temperature data, not trying to consciously do this with the satellite data, but if I make the split point here, these couple of points now fall into the earlier part, gives me a big solar cycle and increasing trend here. Here are the data that are represented by the second half of that record. This actually holds up fairly well in both the southern hemisphere and it holds up in the frequency data as well. So trying to say what the trends are in the data set is tricky because it depends on how you look at it and how you want to put it together. Okay, this is a summary of the points that I tried to raise earlier. Essentially, there are a lot of different things that go into saying what the trends are in the satellite data set. To me, it's not clear that there's a right answer to some of these questions in terms of what should be adopted. I think a very interesting point is that satellite data now seem to be very consistent with what the LMR data have been showing in the last few years, is that the amplitude of the solar cycle signal that we saw in the first portion of the SBV record is a lot smaller now. I don't know why, but it seems to be very consistent. We've got four different instruments running right now. It seems to be there. And I think I'll stop with that. Thanks.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Matt. One other thing before we start discussing this in very interesting paper is we're trying to have podcasts that go along with the presentations. And so we are recording the audio portion of these talks. Jamie Kreutz has been our hero in that particular aspect. And so when you show your slides, I know that you can't say, oh, slide four, slide five, but you might want, if you have a title for the slide, if you could just read the title off so that people can follow, because you'll be, other people outside this group might be interested in listening to the podcast and watching the presentations at the same time. And if they can follow, the slides along with the presentation, it would make it a lot easier. So it just occurred to me while I was sitting here
I meant to do that.
You had some nice titles,
Hopefully the titles explain what they were.
Yeah, maybe.
Where I was.
Yeah, I think people will be able to follow yours.
Okay. If you just say the number, that's still okay?
If you want to show the number, that'd be great. Yeah, that makes it even easier. Yeah. So, Matt, okay. Mike Stevens, can you hand that over to Mike? Dan?
This is Mike Stevens from NRL. I actually have two questions, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Regarding your fourth bullet there, trend magnitude can be affected by method used to combine data sets. Now, as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, the method that is selected is somewhat subjective, right? So what you've shown here for trend estimates and trend magnitudes have uncertainties attached to them, and those are uncertainties that fall out of the regression fit that you do.
Right.
But I guess what's not clear to me is that what is the uncertainty that is reflected in the method that you choose to fit the trend, which, as suggested by this, can be significant. So that's my first question. And then my second question is, it's also not clear to me that you've indicated these trends are different. than what were advertised before, based on the refined analysis that you've done. So it would be useful, given that this is a trend workshop, it would be really useful as this sets the tone for the rest of the workshop, where we were before exactly. And as I understand it, 70 North, we were about 6% a decade, okay, in albedo, and where we are now with the revised analysis. Is there any way we can be quantitative about that?
Okay, let me go ahead and try to address both points. In terms of the method used to combine the data sets, you know, where that comes into play is this question of how do we merge together the different, you know, the particular case I think that I was referring to with this bullet is the case of the question of how do we combine the different data sets together before doing the multiple regression calculation. And so that's this question of the calculated scaling factors to normalize data sets versus having no scaling factors to normalize things. In terms of uncertainty with that, I can show you the results for a whole batch of cases, for albedo, for frequency at different latitudes in different hemispheres, and we can look at what the difference is between the trend number that comes out. Whether that represents an uncertainty or not, it's hard to say because there are different approaches that people might choose to use in combining data sets. It's an uncertainty in that, for example, albedo at 64 to 74 north, you might come up with 1.5% per decade from one method and 6% per decade from another method. I don't know that that means the uncertainty on either one of those numbers is 4.5%. It's a difference between one and the other that you come up with using the different approaches. The uncertainties that are quoted here are the statistical numbers from the multiple regression given a specific choice of how to combine the data sets. In terms of comparing quantitatively the numbers that I've got here to the numbers that we published before, I can look at those numbers, but there are a number of, because of the differences in how things are put together, I'm not sure how meaningful that is. You know, as one single example, in the previous analysis, we took the entire season from 30 days before solstice to 70 days after solstice. Every single thing that we looked at with SBV, that got a lot of essentially blank space because SBV doesn't see a lot of clouds at the ends of the season. In the last couple of years, I look at work that other people are doing for trends, they try to focus on a core season where you essentially have a good amount of activity in PMCs every year. And so what I tried to do for this was to limit the time region to 0 to 40 days. That gives me higher frequency values for every season from the SBV instruments. That's going to mean that the frequency trends are different there, and the brightness trends will be different as well. Regardless of anything else that I do in the analysis, those numbers will be different, in some cases significantly different. The frequency numbers at 74 to 82 are probably twice as large now compared to the numbers that we showed in the 2007 paper. So that's why I hesitate to say, quantitatively, and that's one piece of what has been done differently. The detection threshold, as I described, is significantly different. That's going to give different absolute numbers. So I will be happy to try to pull those numbers out and look at them compared to what I've got, here, but I hesitate to try to say quantitatively that this is what's changed because there are a lot of different pieces that changed and went into it, and I have not tried to go. I have not had the time to try to go through one at a time with all these different changes and look at what happens. It just is not practical.
Okay, we better move on.
I'm not a fan of putting in breakpoints when fitting trends, just because I think that when you talk about a trend, 30 years is a minimum quantity. Mm-hmm. So, and when you start, say, doing 20 years and 10 years, you've probably just degraded your estimate. I mean, you can just ask, what is the variation over 30 years?
I can certainly tell you that the uncertainties on the uncertainty required, the trend required to get 2 sigma significance for that two-part version got larger compared to, I was using Betsy Weatherhead's technique in terms of estimating significance, and sure enough, it does get, it takes a bigger number to be significant for those smaller pieces.
especially when you're trying to fit also a solar cycle in there. I think that's a real problem.
Yeah. But,
okay, that's just one point. Okay. The other point I wanted to make is that this local time issue is really problematic, I think, overall. And even, I mean, maybe we have to start thinking about looking at multiple data sets to estimate what the physics behind the local time variation. There's no, even if you were to pick a single local time and just look at that, you're not, there's no guarantee that your tide, say that that variability is due to a tide. There's no guarantee of a constant tide. We know there's a QBO in the tide, amplitude. We know the phase changes. So I think the only way to get around this and try and normalize the data to take out these uncertainties due to local time variations is to maybe start pulling in other estimates like from tidy of what's the tidal amplitude, or look where we think there is no tidal effect or something like that. As you pointed out, local time variation at high latitudes is much less than it is at low latitudes. So mm-hmm. where you look, or you know, if you're going to make these adjustments, you got to figure in what's driving the local time. So I think, you know, the message here is maybe that there's a big uncertainty on these derived trends, but that doesn't mean there is no trend. Let's just make that clear. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Let me just say, as far as the two-part, I mean, the analysis with the putting in the breakpoint was essentially an exercise that I did last Wednesday, I think it was, not that long ago, and it was driven by is to explore what Lima was showing and to say what comes out of the analysis. It's not to prescribe, you know, not to automatically say, yes, this is what has to be in there, but it was an attempt to say, we actually have long enough piece of SBV data now that we can at least use the multiple regression fitting for the second section of it. I mean, I get, you know, depending on where I set that breakpoint, for example, 96 to 98, it's, you know, 14 years or so for the second piece. Not great, absolutely, especially if there's potentially a solar cycle trend in there. It's at least long enough to try it. But obviously the results come out, you know, are very sensitive to what happens in there.
Okay, I think we better move on. Thanks, Matt. Mark, I think you're up. And.